Chapter 30. And it may be they possessed it a generation ago. But what a morose place has France become since philosophy has dethroned enjoyment. If you go on a visit to one of our noblemen's seats, what do you find there, I ask? Cards, comedies, music, the opportunity for an agreeable intrigue in the society of your equals? No, but a hostess engaged in suckling and bathing her brats, or in studying chemistry and optics with some dirty schoolmaster, who is given the seat of honor at table, and a pavilion in the park to which he may retire when weary of the homage of the great. While as for the host, he is busy discussing education or political economy with his unfortunate guests, if, indeed, he is not dragging them through leagues of mud and dust to inspect his latest experiments in forestry and agriculture, or to hear a pack of snuffling schoolchildren singing hymns to the god of nature. And what, he continued, is the result of it all? The peasants are starving, the taxes are increasing, the virtuous landlords are ruining themselves in farming on scientific principles, the tradespeople are grumbling, because the nobility do not spend their money in Paris, the court is dull, the clergy are furious, the queen mopes, the king is frightened, and the whole French people are yawning themselves to death from Normandy to Provence. Yes, said Castelravinato with his melancholy smile, the test of success is to have had one's money's worth. But experience, which is dried pleasure, is at best a moldy diet, as we know. Yonder, in a fold of those hills, he added, pointing to the cluster of Iganian mountains just faintly penciled above the plain, lies the little fief from which I take my name. Acre by acre, tree by tree, it has gone to pay for my experiments, not in agriculture but in pleasure. And whenever I look over at it from Venice, and reflect on what each root of ground or trunk of tree has purchased, I wonder to see my life as bare as ever for all that I have spent on it. The young Marquess shrugged his shoulders. And would your life, he exclaimed, have been a whit less bare had you passed it in your ancestral keep among those windy hills, in the company of swineherds and charcoal burners, with a milkmaid for your mistress, and the village priest for your partner at picket? Perhaps not, the other agreed. See, there is a tale of a man who spent his life in wishing he had lived differently. And when he died he was surrounded by a throng of spectral shapes, each one exactly like the other, who, on his asking what they were, replied, "We are all the different lives you might have lived." Apostrophe, if you are going to tell ghost stories, cried Pierre Voland, "I will call for a bottle of canary." "And I," rejoined the Count good-humoredly, "will try to coax the ladies forth with a song." And picking up his lute, which always lay within reach, he began to sing in the Venetian dialect. There's a villa on the Brenta where the statues, white as snow, all along the water terrace perch like seagulls in a row. There's a garden on the Brenta, where the fairest ladies meet, picking roses from the trellis for the gallants at their feet. There's an arbor on the Brenta made of yews, that screen the light, where I kiss my girl at midday close as lovers kiss at night. The players soon emerged at this call, and presently the deck resounded with song and laughter. All the company were familiar with the Venetian barcarolles, and Castelravinato's lute was passed from hand to hand, as one after another, incited by the Marquess's canary, tried to recall some favorite measure by Andina in Gondolita or Uarda, Chi Bella Luna. Meanwhile life was stirring in the villages and gardens, and groups of people appearing on the terraces overhanging the water. Never had Odo beheld a livelier scene. The pillared houses with their rows of statues and vases, the flights of marble steps descending to the gilded river gates, where boats bobbed against the landings and boatmen gasped in the shade of their awnings, the marble trellises hung with grapes, the gardens where parterres of flowers and parti-colored gravel alternated with the dusk of tunneled new walks, the company playing at bowls, in the long alleys, or drinking chocolate in gazebos above the river. The boats darting hither and thither on the stream itself, The traveling chaises, market wagons and panieresses crowding the causeway along the bank all were unrolled before him with as little effect of reality as the episodes woven in some gaily tinted tapestry. Even the peasants in the vineyards seemed as merry and thoughtless as the quality in their gardens. The vintage time was the holiday of the rural year, and the day's work was interspersed with frequent intervals of relaxation. At the villages where the birch yellow touched for refreshments, handsome young women in scarlet bodices came on board with baskets of melons, grapes, figs, and peaches, and under the trellises on the landings, lads and girls with flowers in their hair were dancing the manfarina to the rattle of tambourines, or the chant of some wandering ballad singer. These scenes were so engaging to the comedians that they could not be restrained from going ashore and mingling in the village diversions. And the Marquess, though impatient to rejoin his divinity, was too volatile not to be drawn into the adventure. The whole party accordingly disembarked, and were presently giving an exhibition of their talents to the assembled idlers, the pantaloon, Harlequin and Doctor enacting a comical intermezzo which Canto Presto had that morning composed for them, while Scaramouche and Columban joined the dancers, and the rest of the company, seizing on a train of donkeys laden with vegetables for the Venetian market, stripped these patient animals of their panniers, and mounting them bareback started a corso around the village square amid the invectives of the drivers, and the applause of the crowd. Day was declining when the Marquess at last succeeded in driving his flock to their fold, and the moon sent a quiver of brightness across the water as the birch yellow touched at the landing of a villa set amid close-massed foliage high above the river. Gardens peopled with statues descended from the portico of the villa to the marble platform on the water's edge, where a throng of boatmen in the procurator's livery hurried forward to receive the Marquess and his companions. The comedians, sobered by the magnificence of their surroundings, followed their leader like awestruck children. Light and music streamed from the long facade overhead, but the lower gardens lay hushed and dark, the air fragrant with unseen flowers, the late moon just burnishing the edges of the laurel thickets from which, now and again, a nightingale's song gushed in a fountain of sound. Odo, spellbound, followed the others without a thought of his own share in the adventure. Never before had beauty so ministered to every sense. He felt himself lost in his surroundings, absorbed in the scent and murmur of the night. 3.3. On the upper terrace a dozen lackeys with wax lights hastened out to receive the travelers. A laughing group followed, headed by a tall vivacious woman covered with jewels, whom Odo guessed to be the procuratessa Bra. The Marquess, hastening forward, kissed the lady's hand, and turned to summon the actors, who hung back at the farther end of the terrace. The light from the windows, and from the lackeys' tapers fell full on the motley band, and Odo, roused to the singularity of his position, was about to seek shelter behind the pantaloon, when he heard a cry of recognition, and Mirandolina, darting out of the procuratessa's circle, fell at that lady's feet with a whispered word. The procuratessa at once advanced with a smile of surprise, and bade the Cavalier Valseca welcome. Seeing Odo's embarrassment, she added that His Highness of Monte Alloro had already apprised her of the Cavalier's coming, and that she and her husband had the day before dispatched a messenger to Venice to inquire if he were already there to invite him to the villa. At the same moment a middle-aged man with an air of careless kindly strength emerged from the house and greeted Odo. "I am happy," said he bowing, "to receive at Bellocchio a member of the princely house of Pianura, and your excellency will no doubt be as well pleased as ourselves that accident enables us to make acquaintance without the formalities of an introduction." This, then, was the famous procurator Bra, whose house had given 3 doges to Venice, and who was himself regarded as the most powerful, if not the most scrupulous noble of his day. Odo had heard many tales of his singularities, for in a generation of elegant triflers his figure stood out with the ruggedness of a granite boulder in a clipped and graveled garden. to hereditary wealth and influence, he added a love of power seconded by great political sagacity and an inflexible will. If his means were not always above suspicion, they at least tended to statesmanlike ends, and in his public capacity he was faithful to the highest interests of the state. Reports differed as to his private use of his authority. He was noted for his lavish way of living, and for a hospitality which distinguished him from the majority of his class, who, however showy in their establishments, seldom received strangers, and entertained each other only on the most ceremonious occasions. The procurator kept open house both in Venice and on the Brenta, and in his drawing rooms the foreign traveler was welcomed as freely as in Paris or London. Here, too, were to be met the wits, musicians and literati whom a traditional morgue still excluded from many aristocratic houses. Yet in spite of his hospitality, or perhaps because of it, the procurator, as Odo knew, was the butt of the very poets he entertained, and the worst satirized man in Venice. It was his misfortune to be in love with his wife, and this state of mind, in itself sufficiently ridiculous, and the shifts and compromises to which it reduced him, were a source of endless amusement to the humorists. Nor were graver rumors wanting, for it was known that the procurator, so proof against other persuasions, was helpless in his wife's hands, and that honest men had been undone, and scoundrels exulted at a nod of the beautiful procuratessa. That lady, as famous in her way as her husband, was noted for quite different qualities, so that, according to one satirist, her hospitality began where his ended, and the Albergo Bra, the nickname their palace went by, was advertised in the lampoons of the day as furnishing both bed and board. In some respects, however, the tastes of the noble couple agreed, both delighting in music, wit, good company, and all the adornments of life, while, with regard to their private conduct, it doubtless suffered by being viewed through the eyes of a narrow and trivial nobility, apt to look with suspicion on any deviation from the customs of their class. Such was the household in which Odo found himself unexpectedly included. He learned that his hosts were in the act of entertaining the English duke who had captured his Burchiello that morning, and having exchanged his traveling dress for a more suitable toilet, he was presently conducted to the private theater, where the company had gathered to witness an improvised performance by Mirandolina and the newly arrived actors. The procuratessa at once beckoned him to the row of gilt armchairs, where she sat with the noble duke and several ladies of distinction. The little theater sparkled with wax lights reflected in the facets of glass chandeliers, and in the jewels of the richly habited company, and Odo was struck by the refined brilliancy of the scene. Before he had time to look about him, the curtains of the stage were drawn back, and Mirandolina flashed into view, daring and radiant as ever, and dressed with an elegance which spoke well for the liberality of her new protector. She was as much at her ease as before the vulgar audience of Vercelli, and spite of the distinguished eyes fixed upon her, her smiles and sallies were pointedly addressed to Odo. This made him the object of the procuratessa's banter, but had an opposite effect on the Marquess, who fixed him with an irritated eye, and fidgeted restlessly in his seat as the performance went on. When the curtain fell, the procuratessa led the company to the circular saloon which, as in most villas of the Venetian mainland, formed the central point of the house. If Odo had been charmed by the graceful decorations of the theater, he was dazzled by the airy splendor of this apartment. Dance music was pouring from the arched recesses above the doorways, and chandeliers of colored Murano glass diffused a soft brightness over the pilasters of the stuccoed walls, and the floor of inlaid marbles on which couples were rapidly forming for the contra dance. His eye, however, was soon drawn from these to the ceiling which overarched the dancers with what seemed like an Olympian revel reflected in sunset clouds. Over the gilt balustrade surmounting the cornice lolled the figures of fauns, bacchants, Nereids and Tritons, hovered over by a cloud of Amrani blown like rose leaves across a rosy sky, while in the center of the dome Apollo burst in his chariot through the mists of dawn, escorted by a fantastic procession of the human races. These alien subjects of the sun, a fur-clad Laplander, a turbaned figure on a dromedary, a black Amur and a plumed American Indian were in turn surrounded by a rout of Menids and Silenuses, whose flushed advance was checked by the breaking of cool green waves, through which boys wreathed with coral and seaweed disported themselves among shoals of flashing dolphins. It was as though the genius of pleasure had poured all the riches of his inexhaustible realm on the heads of the revelers below. The procuratessa brought Odo to earth by remarking that it was a masterpiece of the divine Tiepolo he was admiring. She added that at Bellocchio all formalities were dispensed with, and begged him to observe that, in the rooms opening into the saloon, recreations were provided for every taste. In one of these apartments silver trays were set out with sherbets, cakes, and fruit cooled in snow, while in another stood gaming tables around which the greater number of the company were already gathering for treset. A third room was devoted to music, and hither Mirandolina, who was evidently allowed a familiarity of intercourse not accorded to the other comedians, had withdrawn with the pacified Marquess, and perched on the arm of a high gilt chair was pinching the strings of a guitar, and humming the first notes of a boatman's song. After completing the circuit of the rooms, Odo stepped out on the terrace, which was now bathed in the whiteness of a soaring moon. The colonnades detached against silver misted foliage, the garden spectrally outspread, seemed to enclose him in a magic circle of loveliness which the first ray of daylight must dispel. He wandered on, drawn to the depths of shade on the lower terraces. The hush grew deeper, the murmur of the river more mysterious. A new arbor invited him, and he seated himself on the bench niched in its inmost dusk. Seen through the black arch of the arbor, the moonlight lay like snow on parterres and statues. He thought of Maria Clementina, and of the delight she would have felt in such a scene as he had just left. Then the remembrance of Mirandolina's blandishments stole over him, and spite of himself he smiled at the Marquess's discomfiture. Though he was in no humor for an intrigue, his fancy was not proof against the romance of his surroundings, and it seemed to him that Miranda's eyes had never been so bright or her smile so full of provocation. No wonder Frattanto followed her like a lost soul, and the Marquess abandoned Rome and Balbec to sit at the feet of such a teacher. Had not that light philosopher after all chosen the true way, and guessed the Sphinx's riddle? Why should today always be jilted for tomorrow, sensation sacrificed to thought? As he sat revolving these questions, the new branches seemed to stir, and from some deeper recess of shade a figure stole to his side. He started, but and was laid on his lips, and he was gently forced back into his seat. Dazzled by the outer moonlight, he could just guess the outline of the figure pressed against his own. He sat speechless, yielding to the charm of the moment, till suddenly he felt a rapid kiss, and the visitor vanished as mysteriously as he had come. He sprang up to follow, but inclination failed with his first step. Let the spell of mystery remain unbroken. He sank down on the seat again, lulled by dreamy musings. When he looked up, the moonlight had faded, and he felt a chill in the air. He walked out on the terrace. The moon hung low and the treetops were beginning to tremble. The villa front was gray, with oblongs of yellow light marking the windows of the ballroom. As he looked up at it, the dance music ceased, and not a sound was heard, but the stir of the foliage, and the murmur of the river against its banks. Then, from a loggia above the central portico, a woman's clear contralto notes took flight. Before the yellow dawn is up, with pomp of shield and shaft, drink we of night's fast-ebbing cup one last delicious draught. The shadowy wine of night is sweet, with subtle slumbrous fumes crushed by the hour's melodious feet from bloodless elder blooms. The days at Bellocchio passed in a series of festivities. The mornings. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.